On Tuesday, December 8th, 1987, an Israeli truck driver lost control of his vehicle and killed four citizens in Gaza. Rumors spread quickly that this was an act of premeditated revenge for the killing of an Israeli settler in Gaza the day before. Arab youths took to the streets. Stones were hurled. Tires were burnt. There was quickly erected barricades to stop traffic. It seemed for a while just another of the periodic incidents which have disrupted Israel's occupation of Gaza and the West Bank since 1967. But the hostilities quickly spread, and for 5 months now have shown few signs of abating. Over these months, youngsters have filled the streets of the West Bank and Gaza, hurling stones, building barricades, taking part in what they now call the Infitada, the Great Awakening. Israel was not prepared for this kind of continuing demonstration. They lacked enough troops trained in crowd control. They seemed to have had no preconceived plan of how to deal with this kind of activity. Defense Secretary Yitzhak Rabin was out of the country when the demonstrations began. It took him a full week to understand their severity and to recover and to return to the country. When he recognized that he faced a massive breakdown, when he got back to Israel, he ordered beatings, tear gas, rubber bullets, massive incarcerations, and a few deportations, combined with severe economic and military and administrative limitations. The Israelis have assumed their practice of punishing troublemakers by sealing up their homes and demolishing them, a technique which the British used with effect in suppressing the Palestine revolt at its peak half a century ago. But none of these repressive measures seem to have done more than to temper the demonstrations. By this week, 170 Arabs have been killed and several Israelis, including a 14-year-old girl who was out on the Tiyul, a walk through the countryside, with a group of school chums. The group was guarded by two Israelis. At first, she was presumed to have been killed by the Arabs, but it turned out she had been wounded by a stray bullet from the guns of one of the Israel guards. A man who by the way, had no right to be where he was, because he had been banned from the West Bank as a man of serious psychological difficulties. Fortunately, the Israelis army quickly revealed the results of an autopsy, and a potentially explosive situation was diffused. But Israel, in any case, set out to furnish the village Beita, to punish the village Beita, from which these youngsters had come. The Israeli Defense Forces dynamited several homes of ringleaders, and six were deported. The results of 5 months of beatings and demonstrations has been a massive blot on the image of Israel. During these months, there's been hardly a newspaper edition which has not featured a large photograph of some armed Israeli soldiers handling or manhandling an Arab youth, or an Arab woman bewailing her dead. There's been saturation coverage of these events from the 700 reporters and photographers in the international press who have been feasting on the spot, looking for feature stories every day. According to a well-known media analyst firm, ADT Research in New York, ABC's World News Tonight, during February, gave over 67 minutes of its prime time to the uprising in Gaza and the West Bank. A distant second was a 21 minutes coverage given to the Central American Peace Plan, the Sandinista, and Contra activities. NBC Nightly News allowed 50 minutes for the uprising and 23 minutes to the coverage of the Central American Peace Plan, which placed second in the amount of time given over to a particular item. CBS Evening News gave the clash between the Israelis and the Palestinians 48 minutes. And the Bush-Dan Rather debate and the question of the vice president's role in the Iran-Contra affair, 33 minutes. In other words, 165 minutes, 23% of the prime time allocated by the major networks to news, international news, went to the Gaza-West Bank story. Now, I am convinced that all of this publicity contributed to the continuation of the uprising. The Arab leaders, who took over from the youth direction of the riots after the first few days, quickly recognized the advantage to the Arab position, which came from the media coverage. I do not fault the media for covering these events. It's a news story, it's an important news story. The events have taken place. There was violence. The Intifada is a story that should be covered. New occupation is a pretty sight. I remember my feelings in the summer of 1967, when just a few days after the conclusion of the 67 war, I drove with a friend through the West Bank and saw the hundreds of white sheets draped at the top of Arab homes. No one in the world should have to admit total impotence. But you would expect at least the better papers would keep some balance in their reporting, that they would at least provide viewers with some background. They would remind their readers and listeners that it is the Arabs, not Israel, who are rioting, that it is any government's responsibility to enforce law and order in its territory. They would remind the world that the Arabs could have had a Palestinian state in 1947 had they accepted partition. Again, in 1967, Jordan might have retained the state, which is the West Bank, had not King Hussein himself turned a deaf ear to Israel's suggestions not to engage himself in the Syrian-Egyptian struggle against Israel. The Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza is not the result of any territorial designs on Israel's part, but a response to a direct attack on Israel. Jordan was one of the states that attacked Israel in 1967. Israel necessarily responded, and Jordan was not able to sustain military control over the territories she had accepted and occupied in the 1947-48 wars. People forgot that immediately after the 1967 war, Prime Minister Levi Eshkol offered to negotiate directly with Jordan and the West Bank and West Bank Arabs on any and all outstanding issues between them. The Arab states, however, turned a deaf ear to every offer of similar nature by the Israeli government over the last 20 years, and there have been a number. One of the reasons that Israelis were surprised by the duration and extent of the present uprising is that their occupation of the West Bank has been a relatively enlightened one. The Arab standard of living has risen. Educational standards have been increased. Money has been spent by Israel to increase the amenities of life, elementary educational facilities, sewage systems, university education, highways, and the like. The Arabs in the West Bank are better off today than they were at any time in the past. Still, no occupation is a pretty sight. There are curfews and restrictions of all kinds, and many causes for disgruntlement. In recent weeks, there have been a number of ugly incidents, such as the attempt by some Israeli soldiers to bury alive four Palestinian youths. Such incidents make for unhappy reading. And in the West, and on the West Bank issue, there's evidence of a strong sense of disapproval in the world, a growing sense of emotional distance from Israel among Jews. Distance has been growing over the past several years. Ever since the invasion of Lebanon, the attacks on the Lebanese army and the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila, the Pollard affair, and the machinations of the Black Hats to have it in Israel all their own way. There is a growing sense that modern Israel is not the Zion of our dreams. All this frustration has been directed at Prime Minister Shamir and the Likud, what is called their adamant refusal to hold and to convene an international conference in the West Bank and Gaza. Now, what we Jews of the diaspora say matters little in determining Israel's policy making. They, not we, must bear the brunt of their decisions. They do not have the privilege of returning to quiet and peaceful homes. But what we do matters a great deal in terms of American public opinion. The United States, after all, matters a great deal to Israel. We send over $3.5 billion a year in various kinds of foreign aid. If American Jewish support for Israel is shattered, that aid can be reduced or deleted very quickly. Diaspora Jewry has benefited immensely from the existence of Israel. Israel has provided a new sense of dignity to our lives, has given a new sense of meaning to being Jewish, has allowed the Jew to walk tall in the corridors of the world. But now that things are not going along quite as we thought they should, quite as we think that is right, the summer soldiers and sunshine patriots among us are voicing privately and sometimes publicly their concerns and their disapproval. And that can have a great deal of effect on the foreign policy and the foreign aid as it dispensed by this country. Now, is this discontent justified? If it is, how should it be shown? Israel had no alternative but to put down this revolt by force. Israel remains under the gun, remains a heavily armed society, not because she has any pretensions against her neighbors, because they have ambitions which can be satisfied only at Israel's expense. There's a rising demand in both Israel and out. The Prime Minister Shamir and the Likud, who are the senior partners at this time in the coalition government, changed their adamant refusal to hold or to be part of an international conference. Many outside of Israel have a simple answer to the problems in the Middle East: land for peace. What the world seems to expect is a conference which will achieve peace, but how this could happen is not clear. There's a much bandied about phrase, land for peace. The Arabs, presumably acknowledging and guaranteeing Israel's right to exist, Israel returning the West Bank and Gaza to Arab sovereignty. This so-called solution has superficial appeal. It seems to do it all. But is it? What territories are indicated when Arabs speak of regaining Palestine? The West Bank and Gaza? Which West Bank? The West Bank of 1947-48? The West Bank of 1967. East Jerusalem, all of Jerusalem, all of Israel. The rioters, I remind you, have issued no policy statements. When interviewed, these 15 and 16-year-olds have spoken simply of ridding the area of Jews. Their motto is the Crusades. After a number of years, the Crusaders admitted defeat, packed up with their swords, and went home. Will, in fact, the return of Gaza and parts of the West Bank mollify the Arabs? Israel is not going to permit Jerusalem to be divided or redivided, and she will insist that it remain her capital, and that strategic military settlements remain in the West Bank as a forward warning system against possible attack. To achieve this desired result, any Palestinian state which would flow from these negotiations must be permanently demilitarized. Will this satisfy Palestinian leadership? It may be if the bargainers represent the land and merchant classes of the West Bank, who think more of trade than of war. But there's no guarantee that these people will have the major say in any major negotiations, or that if they do, that they can sustain their part of the negotiations. Then, too, what government can or will guarantee the results of negotiations? The Palestinians are at present a people without a government. The PLO has pretensions in this direction, but is clearly interested in the larger Arab revolutions than in, more interested in the Arab revolutions than in the problems of Palestine. In the last month, Yasser Arafat has been in Tunis and North Yemen, trying to negotiate the release of the Kuwaiti aircraft and its passengers, rather than in Syria or Lebanon or Jordan, trying to negotiate or trying to gain his way with Israel. The PLO leadership is more interested in the Arab agenda, having to do with oil, hereditary rulers, and the like, rather than with Palestinian rights. The Intifada forced Arabs and Israelis to deal with some hard and unwelcome facts. There are Palestinians. They have legitimate demands. For too long, too many Israelis and too many American Jews have denied the brute fact that the Palestinians are a danger to a Jewish state, not to its legitimacy, but to its survival as a liberal Jewish state. The reasons for this are demographic. The Arabs are not so much a military problem as a population problem. 20 years from now, there will be approximately 2 million Palestinians in the occupied territory, nearly 4.5 million in the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel itself. Given the wide variance of birth rates of Jews and Arabs, by the year 2020, the Jewish and Arab populations of Israel will have attained parity. That is, in a little more than a single generation, the number of Arabs will equal the number of Jews and Israel, the number of Jews. And Israel will be forced to choose between being an open and free society and being a Jewish state. The first response Israel has made to these demonstrations is the one that she had to make. That is, to do all that she could to restore and maintain law and order. How Israel goes about this task is a responsibility only Israel can determine. Israel cannot negotiate with a group of wandering and stormy youth, 15 and 16-year-olds. The suppression of the street attacks seems slowly, however, to be taking hold. It is only the beginning, however. There is, after all, the major issue, the issue of land, the issue of the survival of Israel. By right of conquest, the land belongs to Israel. By the decisions of the United Nations in 1947, the West Bank belongs to the Palestinians, who proceeded to fritter it away by making war against Israel. In 1967, Jordan frittered away the land which she had occupied since 1947. 1948 drained the West Bank of all Jews. But they were there before, in Hebron, Bethlehem, Nablus, and other cities, especially the old city of Jerusalem. And Jews feel very much that they can be there, live in the West Bank again. By rights of necessity, Israel must claim certain land in the West Bank for security purposes. After all, there are today 70,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank, all of whom must be protected. The demilitarization of the West Bank is an absolute necessity. Weapons today are much more powerful and sophisticated than they were 20 years ago, when Arab guns stood within shelling distance of Tel Aviv and of Jaffa. Nobody in Israel would agree to the dismemberment of Jerusalem, and nobody in the Arab world would be satisfied with a negotiated settlement, which involves advanced Israeli security materials, security positions. A final solution to the problems of the West Bank lie way off, I'm afraid, in the future. Media has made it seem that it is Israel that stands in the way of negotiations. But is there any guarantee of an Arab presence? There's no Arab government who signaled its willingness to represent the Palestinians. The Intifada Arabs have not demanded such a conference. They're simply gangs of adolescents fighting against an unwelcome colonial power. When they have been interviewed, there's talk about driving Israel into the sea. Even were Mr. Peres to become prime minister in the November elections, he would be hard put to find a negotiating partner. The gangs of the street are there. They have not proposed any set of demands. They're simply gangs fighting a colonial power. Indeed, there is no group that can come to the bargaining table. Jordan has consistently refused to come. The PLO has a disparaged set of ideologues and gun runners, to whom the events in Lebanon, Tunisia, and Syria are rather more important than those which involve Israel. Indeed, the PLO is no longer a major factor on the actor on this Palestinian scene, and hasn't been since its bases were crushed in Lebanon 4 years ago. The PLO, however, does occupy a spoiler's role. In the past few years, whenever a group of West Bank Palestinians seemed willing to meet to accept an Israeli conference proposal, their leaders were eliminated as fast as the acceptances went out. Riots go on because the Arabs will not negotiate directly with Israel. That is why there is no vehicle available for a negotiated settlement, save an international conference. Arabs may be more predisposed to such a conference than Israel, because it would give them a preponderance of sympathetic listeners, sympathetic nations, to back up their demands. It is assumed that the permanent members of the UN Security Council would be the conveners of such a conference. Of these, neither China nor Russia recognize Israel, and each has a long history of arming the enemies of Israel. Indeed, Russia has sent soldiers and technicians to help the enemies of Israel, and these technicians have fought in every one of the wars against Israel. England and France use politically ambivalent because they're concerned with their investments in the Arab world, particularly in oil. This leaves only the United States as a possibly dependable friend. America is a friend. But America, too, is a set of national interests which may not always coincide with Israel's. We have only to look at the pressures the United States exerting today on Israel in the matter of coming to this conference to realize this fact. Recognizing the adamant refusal of the Arab countries to meet and negotiate, George Shultz has tried to craft diplomatic language which will make it seem as if the convening powers of an international conference would have no agenda except that devising a way of bringing the Palestinians and the Jews to sit down at a single table. But it's hard to imagine a conference with the great powers convened, which would limit itself so narrowly. The United States, after all, can impose on Israel and has done so before. Remember when John Foster Dulles ordered Israeli troops out of Egypt across the Sinai in the 1954 war? Remember that when President Nixon and Henry Kissinger withheld the delivery of arms to Israel for several days at the beginning of the 1972 war, a fact which almost led to the defeat of Israel? Now, the demand for an international conference represents as much a demand by those major powers to protect their interests in the Middle East as it does a sincere willingness to produce negotiated settlements between Arabs and Jews. It's a sad situation. The riots signal that many Palestinians refuse to wait any longer. And it's almost an axiom of modern politics that aroused nationalism can neither be repressed nor held back. For the Palestinians, there is a drive for rights. For Israel, a drive for security. For Americans forced to watch the sad events every night on television, there seems to be a simple solution, and we love simple solutions. Land for peace. American leads that we must act first and do something to brew the to break the impasse. American believes that Israel must act first to relieve the impasse. After all, Israel seems to be the stronger of the two parties. Israel seems to be the occupying power. Israel would seem to have three basic requirements on her part for any negotiated settlement. One, there must be a strong Arab negotiating partner. Two, that partner must offer recognition and peace and be willing to say that whatever settlement is reached marks the end of the Arab-Israeli wars. And three, the Arab parties in the negotiation process must be willing to take full responsibility for the control of their territories. The Palestinian state is not to act as a cover for any party that rejects Israel's existence and seeks to control the West Bank and Gaza only as a first step in the dismemberment of Israel. Now, if Israel is to give up territory, it must get something in return. What it must get is peace, a solid peace, peace that would be secure. We hear horror stories about the Jewish reaction to the Intifada demonstrations. Some of them are true. Mayor Kahana has called upon Israel to expel all Arabs from the country as a solution to this problem. He's not alone. A few months ago, the Minister of Health, Joseph Shapiro, proposed that Israel be encouraged to bribe Arabs to immigrate. Michael Dekal, Deputy Minister of Defense, spoke of a forced transfer of population from the West Bank to the East Bank, which much as took place at the end of the Second World War. Population transfer is obviously one solution, but it is one that neither the Palestinians nor any right-minded person would accept. And Israeli society generally will not accept such a proposal, fortunately. But there has been a rise in support for the groups espousing this kind of proposal. There's rising support for Tehillah, the party of the Jewish rightists, and for Kach, Meir Kahan's small racist party. In politics, for every action, however, there's an equal and opposite reaction. There is Shalom Achshav, Peace Now, a group which became a major force in recent years in support of such actions as Israel's withdrawal from the Sinai, opposition to the invasion of Lebanon, and now they demand that Israel take the bull by the horn and bargain in good faith. Since Intifada began, Shalom Achshav has mounted six national demonstrations, each of which drew thousands of people. Fortunately, this is not a complete dati against lo dati, religious against secular Jews issue. A group of the Orthodox Dove have come together to create Oz of Shalom, courage and strength, which emphasizes peace and whose schools study traditional religious texts which oppose nationalism and xenophobia. The problem is that its citizens are about evenly divided on matters which affect Israel's survival. There is in Israel today a government of national unity precisely because at this moment there is no national unity. Population transfer is obviously one possible solution, but it is obviously one that Palestinians would not accept, nor for that matter would Israelis. Is the international conference then the answer? There are innumerable problems in convening such a conference. Is it worth it? Would an international conference promote peace in the Middle East? I believe that in many ways it is an invitation to failure. George Shultz has insisted it is intended to be only a convening conference. The actual bargaining should take place face to face between Palestinians and Israelis. It's clear that such a conference would have a more important focus. It would be a way for the world to tell Israel and the Palestinians what is expected of them. And you can be sure that Israel will get the short end of the stick. Israel is, after all, more subject to international pressures. She doesn't have oil. She doesn't have a large backlog of land. And she doesn't have a great reservoir of people. As the United Nations debates over the past 40 years have made clear, in the world of politics, it's oil and wealth that count. In the world of international politics, Israel has few, if any, dependable friends. There is no simple solution to the problems posed by an international conference. Israelis have national security issues to face. The Arabs' demands based on nationalism. Their demands are based on nationalism. As long as the Palestinians, both within and without the territories, insist that it is a contest between two nationalism, then Israel must insist that history must choose Jewish nationalism. The choice must be made. This choice must be made. All negotiations will fail. If a land for peace negotiation is convened, there are any number of dangers in it for Israel. There is a danger that Palestine will have an unstable government, and that a new, more radical government will come to power. That it is not, and then one that is not necessarily convinced of the value of peace. After the agreement is signed and the Israeli troops have withdrawn, the West Bank government could be quickly ousted by the PLO or some other radical group and replaced by one which renounces all the accords which have been signed. It's not unknown in the Arab world. There is a danger that Israel will then have to fight against a much closer and better armed enemy. If Israel is forced to choose prematurely between the two approaches, then she will be faced with a situation which, unlike that of Camp David, forces her to negotiate with something less than a sovereign state. Secondly, Israel must mortgage its military security for the goodwill and indulgence of the world community. If there is an independent Palestinian state in the West Bank, then Israel will have less defensible. Its survival would depend less on its own strength and more on its capacity to appropriate the major powers of the world who might come to its aid. Then, too, there is the danger of civil war in Israel itself. Israelis are almost evenly divided on this issue. Many of the Jews are fanatic on one side or the other. Jews shooting at Jews has not happened in 40 years, but it did happen during the War of Independence. Is not impossible. Each side believes that the other is threatening, and each side will take action to protect its decisions. From any point of view, a negotiated settlement will be difficult to achieve, and even more difficult to maintain. Israel offered in November to negotiate the outstanding issues with the Joint Palestinian-Jordan Board. That offer was turned down unceremoniously. Yet clearly, something must be done. The majority of us believe that working out an arrangement with the Palestinians is to Israel's benefit, because only by ridding herself of the Palestinian problem can Israel save itself. It is here that escape, yet it is mere escapism to believe that unilateral autonomy, unilateral withdrawal, or the PLO state, all of which have been proposed, will rid Israel of the Palestinian problem. At present, the solution that everyone would be the Jordanian option. But the possibility of that happening is waning quickly, as Hussein lacks the courage to stand up and be counted. He's lacked it for 40 years. He's a long record of copping out. 1948, The solution is for time to pass, which will allow a new generation of Arab leaders to rise who have reason to believe that that accommodation with Israel is desirable and possible. But it must be admitted that today that next generation of leaders is sadly lacking. The training which Palestinians receive in their schools, in their homes, and in the street makes it unlikely that new leadership will be more accommodating. Now, a word to those who say, do something, do anything, who feel that the news is so bad that we have to negotiate, who feel that the solution must be forced upon Israel. These would risk Israel's history and future to satisfy their diaspora needs and to relieve them of the anguish of the moment. Israel must do what it can to encourage the emergence of representative Palestinian groups. But alone, Israel does not have the power to create that kind of leader, the kind of leaders who are responsible, who can form these groups. This is a task for the Palestinians themselves, and it will take some time, perhaps generations of time. What then is the solution? There really is no solution. Only we can hope and pray that in time, a solution will appear. In the meantime, a phased process such as that envisaged in the Camp David Accords, in which initial agreements on some minor issues might lead to progress on more complex and divisive issues. If any international conference is convened, it should have limited authority and very, very limited expectations. It will all take time, a great deal of time. In the meantime, let's not fault Israel for her repressive measures. She has to take these against the wandering youth gangs. She does what she has to do because she is responsible for law and for order. The issues remain for Israel and for the Palestinians. One issue remains paramount. Can they sit at a single table? And before they do that, I'm afraid much time must pass. Amen.